So this session today is about the colonisation of Australia, which was brutal and genocidal. The military and the police continue to repress and control Indigenous populations across this country. And this session is going to explore the history of that resistance on Palm Island and in the Kimberley. So Gavin is an Aboriginal activist based in Sydney and a member of Socialist Alternative. He is from Gumbangia country, from the Coffs Coast. Gavin joined the organisation in 2015 after becoming politically active in protest for Aboriginal rights and justice, particularly the campaign to save the block, one of the last remaining urban inner city Aboriginal communities that is facing gentrification in Sydney. He's an activist in the National Tertiary Education Union and has been involved in the fight against government funding cuts and opposing the offshore refugee detention centres on Manus Island and Nauru. Gavin is also the cousin of one of the three children from Bowerville that over the course of 6 months in 1990 and 1991 were murdered. Despite a heroic fight by the families and community, their killer has still not been brought to justice. So I would like to invite you to welcome Gavin and again welcome to Marxism 2019.
I don't know if this... everyone can hear me, yeah?
Yeah.
Awesome. That's a good start. Yeah, thank you, Kathy, for the welcome. I just wanted to, I guess, start off by saying that one of my most valuable resources for this talk and for many of my talks is the Marxist Left Review, particularly Tom Bramble's article, which talks about the politics of law and order. So I'm going to be talking a bit more about that in relation to Aboriginal people, but that is a valuable resource to kind of delve a bit more into, you know, to develop our understanding of police brutality and the politics of law and order. I guess before I start my talk, I wanted to just say that this kind of story will kind of give you a bit of a context as to where I'm going to go with my talk today. I looked at Facebook this morning when I was jumping on the tram, and there was an article in there that said that there was an Aboriginal woman in the Northern Territory who had the police barge into her house for no reason. They then breath tested her in her house. They then arrested her for being over some imaginary limit. And when she was acquitted of the crime that she'd never committed, they then tried to appeal it and in order to try and, you know, get a conviction out of her. So that gives you an idea of where I'm going to go with my talk today. The colonisation of Australia was brutal and genocidal. The military, the police, and other arms of the Australian state continue to repress and oppress and control Aboriginal populations right across this country. The title of my session, From Palm Island to the Kimberley, could have been named any other communities, any other towns in this country, and, you know, prisons, you know, child detention centres, this kind of thing. So kind of an example, you know, we could have called it from Redfern to Geraldton. We could have called it from Dondale to Long Bay. You know, there's many different examples of this kind of disgusting oppression that takes place in this country. And the point of this talk today is to not only recognise and look a bit more into that history, but also celebrate the resistance to that oppression that happens every waking day that we live in this this genocidal country. January 26, 1788 is Invasion Day, the day that British imperialists brought with them disease, livestock, and the project of setting up a white outpost for colonial empire. This invasion marks the early stages of introduction to capitalism to this continent, the class-divided society, where a tiny minority profit, you know, fat in their pockets, lie in their pockets, of the exploited labour of the majority of working people. The police as an institution has always existed to uphold and maintain this status quo of exploitation. The racist institutions of the police force was fundamental to the colonial project in this country. Australian capitalism could not exist without it. Police racism is a symptom of the establishment of the racist Australian state, a state which could not which could not exist without the genocide, without the repression, and without the assimilation of Aboriginal people. In the case of Queensland, for example, that state was literally built off the slave labour of Aboriginal workers and South Sea Islanders. And according to history and historians, upwards of $1 billion was taken from Aboriginal and South Sea Islander slave labour in the form of stolen wages. And that still hasn't been paid back. The police have always served in the interests of big business, whether it be from the exploitation of those workers, and more generally, the government's attempts to organise this exploitative and racist regime. Capitalism is responsible for the dispossession and oppression which continues to this day. The stolen generations, the way it's framed is if it's a historical issue, but it's still very much taking place today, where you had, Aboriginal children en masse being taken from their children, taken from their families. Those policies have been fundamentally tied and enforced by the state police and the federal police. In fact, it's very common for people to identify the police in the streets because you're worried about, your children, you're thinking about what is going to happen and they're going to point us out, these kind of things. These children will then, when they were taken, they were sent to workhouses. You've euphemistically called girls or boys' homes or Christian missions, or in wealthy households to work as slave labour for white middle-class families. The document Servant or Slave, the documentary, that played at the Marxism conference a couple of years ago, I think really kind of aptly describes the experience of young Aboriginal children when they were locked up in these girls' or boys' homes. The case of Auntie Adelaide I wanted to highlight was one where it was quite telling of the system that they have to endure. She was stolen at the age of 4 by the police and sent to Cootamundra Girls' Home. She would be repeatedly beaten to the point of, black and blue, and was attacked at one point by one of the officers of the state with a cat-and-nine-tails whip. Auntie Adelaide's story is just one of thousands that have taken place across this country. The state prosecuted this racist policy by arguing that the pure-blood Aborigines or the pure-blood race of Aboriginal people would eventually die out. Therefore, the half-caste children, as the state called them, needed to be saved and assimilated into white society. The reality is best laid out from the horse's mouth. As the, and this is his actual title, the Chief Protector of Aborigines in the North, sounds like something out of Game of Thrones, Dr. Cecil Evans Cook put it, generally, by the fifth and invariably the sixth generation, all native characteristics of Australian Aborigines are eradicated. The problem of our half-caste will quickly be eliminated by the complete disappearance of the black race and the swift submergence of their progeny into the white. He continued, the Australian native is the most easily assimilated race on earth, physically and mentally. A blending of the Asiatic, though tending to increase fertility, is not desirable. The quickest way is to breed them white. What this policy amounted to was outright genocide, the wage theft of entire generations of Aboriginal children, the theft of entire generations of Aboriginal children. This policy fit very well with the broader approach to the Aborigine question by the state. That being, how best do they clear the land of Aboriginal people and rob them of any ability to claim historical or current connection to the land? It's important to note that at the same time that these children were being stolen from their families, entire clans were being massacred on the frontier. The responsibility to execute these orders fell squarely at the feet of the police, and they did everything in their power to carry out their boss's orders. But as I said, this is not just a historical phenomenon. It is very much embedded to the modern racist Australian state and its approach to Aboriginal people. So like in the 1800s, the police are on the front line, this time more rabid and weaponised. In 2008, Kevin Rudd stood in Parliament House to formally apologise for the stolen generations. Yet this only provided cover for the significant ramping up of Aboriginal people and children being stolen from their families. Most notably, the increase in New South Wales, which at the time was governed by the Labor Party. In New South Wales, nearly 1 in 10 Aboriginal children had been removed from their families. Of every 1,000 children removed from their families in New South Wales, around 83 are Aboriginal. Since the government and the military invasion of the Northern Territory, Aboriginal communities, known as the NT intervention, was begun by John Howard in 2007, the rate of child removals in the Northern Territory has increased by 80%. While the language has changed, the racist goals at the heart of it are always the same. Because the struggle, because of struggle and internal developments of Australian capitalism, child removals and other racist policies have been justified by appealing to the more liberal middle-class prejudices towards Aboriginal people, instead of the outright genocidal rhetoric of, you know, for example, breeding out the black, which was one of the common terms up until the 60s, really. The state now argues that Aboriginal mothers and fathers are too unfit to look after their children, that the state has to intervene into their lives for the good of Aboriginal children, an argument that could not be distinguished from the Liberal Party's Northern Territory intervention of 2007, something that is only further entrenched by the Labor Party following the 2007 election. And we had to be clear what this looks like in practice. So in New South Wales alone, children are only Aboriginal children are only 5% of under 18s, yet they make up 37% of all young people in state care. Last year in New South Wales, the state government also announced that it would legislate forced adoptions for any Aboriginal children who were in out of home care for more than 2 years. What makes matters worse is, you know, this in New South Wales alone, that they spent upwards of $1.8 billion on these policies, which have effectively led to further entrenching of Aboriginal children being taken into out-of-home care. And now, as I said, being put up for adoption after 2 years and, you know, never seen again, really. The story is the same, if not worse, across the country. In Victoria, for example, the Commissioner for Aboriginal Children and Young People found that Aboriginal children were 16 times more likely to be in out-of-home care than non-Aboriginal children. According to the 2014 report, the rate of Aboriginal child removal in Victoria exceeds that at any time that existed under white settlement. That's an indictment. Child services is just one of the areas where the racist police force sits to flex their muscles and their power towards Aboriginal youth. Aboriginal youth detention is an entirely oppressive apparatus in its own right. The revelations at Dondale Detention Centre that featured in Four Corners gives us a clear understanding and picture of the real face of the police force, the correction services and the courts. The Four Corners report showed Aboriginal children, Aboriginal youth being held in solitary confinement for upwards of 23 hours a day. Children as young as 14 being tear gassed, the use of fabric hoods like those on that were shown in a report on Dylan Voller, and forcing each other to fight and eat animal feces in exchange for junk food. Horrible. This climate of dog-eat-dog was actively cultivated by the prison guards in the centre. Astonishing that this took place under not only the Liberal Party, but consecutive Labor governments. While debate raged internationally and around the world about the same practices being used on detainees in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay. The report in Dondale was prompted by events that occurred in the centre in 2014. The report filed claimed by police that five young Aboriginal children had escaped their cells, assaulting staff with shards of glass, bricks and steel poles. The footage showed the children rioting against the brutal treatment that they had been forced to endure. The police and the security response was swift and it was brutal. Scenes of the children essentially being waterboarded, lying face down in the concrete, shocked the nation. The guards just passed it off as cleaning the inmates' from the tear gas. Firstly, many of these children were imprisoned through petty crime. So we've got to think about, why are these young people in these places? In one case in the Northern Territory, a child was sent to one of these detention centres for stealing a Mars bar. In the wake of the report, no security or police officer has been charged or held accountable for any of the disgusting scenes that we saw play out. And in 2018, it was revealed that Aboriginal children made up 100% of the youth detainees in the Northern Territory youth detention system. The racism endemic to the state and police force gives no room for reform unless it's forced to. So in December last year, when the Aboriginal youth in Dalandale rebelled again, I mean, the fact that that sentence even exists, the fact that Dondale still exists after the report tells you something. But in the wake of that, the next riot in 2018, they basically sent in the riot response, the Northern Territory Riot Response Group, which is an elite force that's established to basically smash protests and historically, and resistance and rebellions. And historically, they've been used on the Aboriginal community. And so, true to its record, the now governing Territory Labor Party is, instead of rounding back the Dondale Detention Centre and youth incarceration more generally, they're increasing it. So they've just, not just recently, but they announced that they were going to be investing $17 million into expanding and rebuilding Dondale, as well as, building more detention centres around the country. So around Northern Territory. So in Alice Springs, they want to build another detention centre. In that particular region alone, it's one of the highest, populations of young Aboriginal people under the age of 18. The way that they see it is, let's put more prisons there instead of build and develop community programs to help and these kind of things. So you can see, even after this crisis, the Labor Party's response is more racism. across the board, it's getting worse. Over the past three decades, successive state and federal governments, Liberal and Labor, had shifted towards the harsh criminal justice regimes. Common features include toughening bail conditions, lengthening sentences, tightening access to parole, and other restrictions. The result has been a rapid increase in imprisonment. Since 1975, the number of prisoners has increased fivefold, and the imprisonment rate stands at a record and historic high. Police numbers are also increasingly present and increasing on our streets. And anyone from Melbourne only has to go down the main street in this city and see, like, you could probably spot maybe five cops. And I mean, that's an exaggeration, but, a lot of police. The ramping up the police, just in sheer numbers, is a core feature of the shift of authoritarianism. It's also clear that these policies and the increasing authoritarianism disproportionately target Aboriginal people. So like the woman that I mentioned at the start, Indigenous people are massively more likely to be jailed, making up 2% of the 2% of the population, but 28% of the prison population. In WA, at any one time, more than 4 in 100 Indigenous adults are in jail. And in the Northern Territory, 3 in 100. 9% of Indigenous people and 15% of Indigenous males aged over 15 have been to prison at one point in their lives, while just 5% of Indigenous people hold a university degree. So it kind of gives you an idea of the disparity there. For Indigenous youth, those aged between 10 and 17, the situation is still worse. They are 18 times more likely to be in detention than non-Indigenous youth and represent one half of those in the juvenile justice system. Poverty and racism are fundamental drivers of imprisonment. Insufficient funds to pay decent legal services or representation and pressure to the on-duty solicitors that are provided by the state, whether it be legal aid, Aboriginal Legal Service, all these organisations are constantly being squeezed by federal and state governments. This means that the defendants don't have a chance in court. When you go in there, you're more likely to be told to plead guilty because you're more likely to get a less harsher sentence, even though you didn't you wouldn't have even done the crime. And that's even before the racist attitudes that the judges are taking into account. Unpaid fines incurred, for example, for swearing at a cop, are considered disorderly conduct. Those charges are brought against Aboriginal people far more than non-Indigenous people. And a regular theme of imprisonment for Aboriginal people. Lack of fluency in English can condemn Aboriginal people to jail through fails to understand the court process. The inability to make court due to not having access to services to get your driver's license, these kind of things. These are the real world issues that Aboriginal people face that directly lead to them more likely being incarcerated. And as I said, that's before you even get to the coalface of the racist police system. In 101 ways, the criminal justice system finds methods to incarcerate Aboriginal people. The racism is built into the DNA of the modern capitalist state. It serves a key function in keeping the system of exploitation and profit accumulation churning. And so when you want to run the capitalist state, racism becomes your tool and less a cancer that needs to be eradicated in society. So Labor and Liberal, for example, have no interest in bettering the lives of Aboriginal people or youth. Solutions to the problems that we face, that my people face in this country, are not going to be found in their party platforms. They continue to peddle the same racist law and order authoritarianism that we've seen over the last decade. One could argue that there's significant evidence to suggest that there's a cradle to grave approach by the state when it comes to policing Aboriginal children and Aboriginal communities. Youth detention has been a black spot on the state for decades, but it's been significantly overshadowed by the even more barbarous instances of black deaths in custody. It's the most overt and blatant form of state racism that Aboriginal people face, though it's only an issue in mainstream consciousness because there's been a movement by the Aboriginal community since the 70s to push back against black deaths in custody. That was led by figures like Arthur Murray and Leela Murray, who eventually fought for a Royal Commission. The Royal Commission, obviously, I'll go into it a bit more later, but people know it was trash. Murders of Aboriginal people by the state had continued well before the campaign for against black deaths in custody had started. However, it was the outrage sparked by the murder of an Aboriginal man by the name of John Pat in WA in September 1983 that launched the campaign. So at the time, one Aboriginal person was murdered by police or prison guards every 11 days. Police brutality towards Aboriginal people was widespread. The campaign was intense and sometimes brutal, but it eventually forced the federal government to launch the Royal Commission. And in 1991, it handed down 339 recommendations on how the federal and state governments should reform criminal law in order to stop the murder of Aboriginal people by the police. It's 2019 and less than 11 of those recommendations have been implemented, and things have only gotten worse. One of the countless cases, one of many cases, I guess is a better way to put it, is that of David Dungay. And people might know of David's name. It's a very prominent case just because of the way in which it was carried out, the way in which he was murdered, and subsequently the way in which the courts have denied his family justice for his murder. In 2015, David was brutally set upon by prison guards in Long Bay Jail for trying to eat a Tim Tam. They were his Tim Tams, and they were in his cell. And because he tried to eat them, the riot response group within the prison itself charged into his cell, held him down, brutally kind of just, suppressed his any movement to the point where he started screaming, "I can't breathe." And he screamed, "I can't breathe," 12 times. And during this moment, they had injected him with a sedative called midazolam. And that effectively is a tranquilizer. It was in that process, screaming, "I can't breathe," that he eventually went blue and died. At this point, the case is still ongoing, as I said. But I think that we have to be very skeptical of the institutions, the police, the courts, investigating themselves and finding themselves guilty. Pardon?
Not guilty.
No, I mean, they're never going to find themselves guilty. Yeah. So I think the thing about this is, though, wherever there's this like this blatant form of oppression, there's always going to be resistance. Oppressed people always fight back. We never just accept the oppression that we had dealt with. And so the Aboriginal Tent Embassy, I think, is a good example of this in the 1970s, which was a flashpoint of resistance, not only for the Black Rights Movement, but for the LGBT movement, women's rights across the board. And it was a key moment for the emerging Black Panther Party and Black Power movements. The federal government was genuinely frightened by the emergence of black radicals around the country. Figures like Gary Foley, Mama Shirl, and Chica Dixon were put under heavy surveillance for years during this period. And that's Gary Foley there. I wanted to have slides which kind of speak to this section of the talk. And particularly it's referring to a documentary by the ABC called ASIO Files, which they did a report. There was a reporting on the ABC that kind of went through the files, and one of them was focused on Gary Foley. And it was something that they did quite, intensely. Like, they followed him everywhere. There's photos of him at rallies, you know, going to his house, going into the office of the Communist Party. You know, like, they really were worried about these people, because they recognised that, you know, people like Gary Foley, Mama Shirl, and the movement that they embodied and kind of expressed through their activism, they recognised if that linked up with the organised working class, so, you know, trade union leaders that were organised in the Communist Party, if they made those links, that would be a force to reckon with, and they wouldn't be able to, it'd be a sticky situation for them to have workers fighting against racism and fighting against exploitation. And so it's something that they severely, severely repressed. As I said, through the ASIO files, it kind of gives you an idea of that. And everyone should go and check that out themselves. But this form of resistance that Gary Foley was engaged with hasn't stopped, and it's been ongoing for the past 4 decades. And so we only have to look at, you know, in our recent history, in 2004, you know, moments like the Redfern riot, in other moments like, you know, Palm Island, which was to come later. It's moments like these where you have just sheer outrage and, you know, a flashpoint of struggle against this oppression. So in Redfern on the Block, the land of the Gadigal people, it has long been a political and social hub for Aboriginal people in New South Wales and across the country. The riot itself was sparked when the young Aboriginal boy, 14-year-old TJ Hickey, was murdered by the local police. He was set upon when he was riding home from his aunt's place to his from his mum's place to his aunt's, and his bike was rammed by the police. He was then thrown into the air and impaled on a fence in 3 points on his body. He would later die in the hospital the next day. Although witnesses corroborate these events in exactly that way, how it kind of played out. The state government, the police, the federal government, John Howard, all these figures came out and they said, no, that's not what happened. He was riding. He tripped himself and he killed himself effectively. And so, you know, you had figures like Bob Carr, who was the Labor Premier at the time of New South Wales. You know, as I said, John Howard, they were backing the police to the hilt, 100%. And so, you know, that kind of, the experience of the Aboriginal community at the time was one of just you know, rank racism. And that was a moment in which the community said, no, we can't take this any further. We need to resist. We need to fight. And so within hours, literally, they'd organised a leaflet to be going out, not only to within the inner city suburbs, but out into the west. And the Aboriginal community put a call out to people to say, we need to gather here because we need to fight and we need to resist. And it was a pitched battle between the police and Aboriginal youth, Aboriginal elders, Aboriginal women and men, all coming together to stand against the police. There was about 150 to 200 of them. And it went for hours near the main street of Redfern, outside of the train station. You know, there were people at the time, I would call them small L liberals, who said that the riot had been a waste of time. But I think with that, we have to say, you know, TJ Hickey's name would never be a national phenomena if it wasn't for the resistance that his community, you know, put and I guess pushed forward at that moment. TJ, there would never be questioning of the police, of, you know, of the government and of the, I guess, of their practices if there wasn't this resistance and rebellion against it. And so I think it's a similar situation if you only have to look at, you know, a couple of months after the Redfern riots, where there was the riot of in Palm Island. And I think I want to go into a bit more about the history of Palm Island, but I don't have much time. So I'll just say really quickly, it was a prison island that was set up by the state government to basically put Aboriginal radicals and other militants, you know, probably trade unionists, these kind of things. And they would use it as a prison island, effectively. You know, Aboriginal people were chained up in the streets up until the 50s on Palm Island. So it kind of gives you an idea of the history of this place. And, you know, the kind of... That is the bedrock. That is the racist depression. I think that is the backdrop to the explosive riots that took place in 2004 when Mulrunji Dumaji was murdered by the local police officer, Chris Hurley. He had been walking along the side of the street and, you know, singing Who Let the Dogs Out while the cops had just happened to drive past, and they didn't like that. So they pulled up, threw him in the back of the paddy wagon, took him back to the police station and beat him to death. The reports showed that he had a ruptured spleen, a ruptured liver. The coroner's report said that he had injuries consistent with a car crash victim. And this is in a police cell. Yeah. So Chris Hurley, yeah, literally beat the crap out of him. The inhumanity, I guess the barbarism of this individual is just astonishing. Not the right word. It's disgusting. And so immediately after that, the community came out and they said, well, we know the police here are racist. We know there's something else to this. You know, Mulrunji didn't just fall over and rupture his spleen and, you know, also have a car accident. You know, like, they obviously knew what was going on and they protested. They came out into the streets and demanded that the police, the state government, answer their questions about why Mulrunji was murdered and what had happened and what had taken place. And within moments, that protest had turned into a riot. And the reality is, because the police weren't interested in giving answers, they weren't interested in, I guess, addressing the concerns of the community. They immediately went into lockdown. So the rioters, you know, they literally just tore up the place. And all credit to them, to be honest. The experience of being in Palm Island and Aboriginal, I guess, you know, thinking about it, every person in your household from, you know, the first generation, you know, to the third would have experienced some form of, like, harsh brutality from the police. And so you can understand why people would rightly want to resist and rebel against that. And they burnt down the police station, they burnt out the courthouse, they really turned it into kind of a microcosm of explosive resistance of the oppressed, a moment when, you know, this Aboriginal community was able to take their own destiny into their own hands and assert their own humanity in that process. And I guess it's amazing, and the outcomes of that, I think, speak to the impact that the riot had on not only the police but within the community itself. You know, Mulrunji's name, like TJ's, was a national name, a national phenomenon. People knew about it, and Chris Hurley actually was one of the first and only prison officers to be charged for a murder in custody of an Aboriginal person. So it was quite important that they resisted in the way that they did. The problem is, though, that we know that the system itself will take every opportunity to, you know, wash its hands of blood, to patch up any inconsistencies in their story. And Chris Hurley would later be let off. He would later then be... you know, given a, I guess, compensation, I think is the way they put it, of $100,000, he was then awarded, along with the 33 other police officers on the prison island. He was awarded I think it's like a Medal of Honor. It's like the highest order within the Queensland Police. Yeah. So this is the guy that had beaten Mudurundji to death. So unlike countless working class communities across the country and across, you know, across in our communities, the abuse of working people by the police largely goes unrecognized by the press and the media and these kind of things. But in Redfern and Palm Island, the story was different. They had to recognize and they had to actually, you know, talk about it. They couldn't just black it out as something that never happened. And that's because of the resistance that they had put up in that moment. And so I think that was the best thing about the riots. They sent a signal that ordinary people are willing to fight back. They're willing to stand up. They're willing to actually assert themselves and push back against the police and their oppression. And I think the Sydney Morning Herald article, which talks about the Redfern riots that I was able to find, I think really kind of puts it into perspective. And they said that the day after the riots, the headline was, "It takes a riot for us to recognise these children." That was the headline. So it kind of speaks to that force that oppressed people can impose on history through their own activity and through their own resistance. And so I guess to wrap up, today we're seeing the same form of oppression, the same form of racism, just the barbarism of the police and prisons and the court system towards Aboriginal people. And as Kathy said, you know, my family is going through a 30-plus year battle just to get justice for three Aboriginal children who were murdered by a white racist. So the policing continues. You know, this continues because we still live under capitalism. We still live under a system that fundamentally relies on racism in order to prop up and uphold exploitation and oppression. We still live under the system that breeds and, you know, just like drips through the pores every day, this violence that we see. That system continues unabated. But as a struggle against racism and a struggle against police brutality can severely disadvantage is severely disadvantaged without the politics that plants racism and the policing of black communities within the broader context of the capitalist system itself. As Gary Foley said, change has never come through asking or, you know, begging the powers that be to accede to our demands. It has only come through mass action on the streets, mass activism and mass organising. And so I think it's our task today, and for anyone who wants to take this question seriously and wants to actually fight and resist racism and oppression, I think it's our task to understand the capitalist system while at the same time building the movements on the streets in the fight for dismantling the system and the entire apparatus. I'll leave it there.